further, so to speak, introduction and reinforcement of this idea, which he spoke about of the significance of the words of the Chachamim, and encouraging us to be very, very careful in trying to understand them, recognizing that they are, that there's depth, before rejecting it because it sounds funny or because it doesn't sound, you know, intuitively correct. So now we move on to substance, to specific examples, illustrations, issues where the words of the Chacham impose present a surprising result, and he's going to make an effort with a few examples to try to explain each one. The issues over here, so to speak, are not global issues necessarily, although as you will see, many of them of course certainly do strike up with what we would call global issues. His first example, his first concern, is the din of Edim Zomimim. The law of Edim Zomimim. Edim Zomimim we would translate usually as plotting, P-L-O-T-T, or scheming witnesses. The Torah says the following law. It's a parsha in Sefer Dvarim. It speaks about an Eid Chamas Be'ish Lanos Bosara, when a corrupt witness tries to go and testify falsely against somebody. And what happens? So the judges go and they investigate the matter. And the verse, the way it says, and they behold, they see the Eid Sheker Ho'Eid, Sheker Anabach. If they discover that he's a liar, that the witnesses have been testifying falsely against their subject. So the Gemara says, well, you know, how are they able to tell? The specific situation that where this rule applies, the Gemara says, is where two other witnesses come, and they say about the first set, what? They're testifying that on Tuesday at 1 o'clock in Baltimore, they saw Reuven kill Shimon. Can't be, because Tuesday at 1 o'clock we were playing golf with them in Pennsylvania. So therefore they couldn't even have been there. So you pull out the rug from under the witnesses, and that shows them to be false. So what's the rule? Vasisem lo kasher zomam lasos lo'achiv uviyarto haram mikir becha. You should do to them, to the scheming witnesses, as they had planned to do to their brother. That's the consequence. That's going to be the consequence of this action. Whatever they wanted to bring on their subject, the subject of their testimony, you will do to them. If they wanted him to be killed because they were testifying that he was a murderer, then we take out them and we kill them. If they testify that he had to pay $3,000 for whatever, then they have to pay $3,000, and so on and so forth. That's the way it works. When it's possible to give kasher zomam, when it's possible to give according to the plot, that's what you will give. The Mishnah says in Makkos Daf Hey, Eina Edim Zomimim Nerogim Ad Sheyigamer Hadin. Edim Zomimim will only be killed if their testimony went so far down the line in the court case that based on their testimony, the court indeed decided that Reuven gets the death penalty, and then the new pair of witnesses come screeching around the bend, pull up in front of the courthouse, jump out and say, "One second, right, hold the ropes, don't throw the switch yet. Right? We have counter testimony." However, if they just gave the testimony and it didn't go any place like that, then they won't be killed. Now, the Tzedukim, says the Mishnah, the Sadducees went further. They said that they don't get killed unless they actually caused the murder to take place. Shereat Tzedukim Aymim Achi Yehorek, Shenemar Nefesh Tachas Nefesh. Because there's a notion of Nefesh Tachas Nefesh, of a soul for a soul, and therefore they understand that it has to actually have happened. It has to have actually occurred. L'chos ochos einecha, nefesh b'nefesh, ayin b'ayin, shein b'shein, yad b'yad, regel b'regel, eye for eye, etc. One of the places where the Torah says this, so they understand it has to have been taken. Omru lehem chachamim, the sages responded and they said, v'alo kfar nemar, v'asisem lo kasher zomam lasos le'ochiv. They should do to them like they plotted, like they schemed to do, you do to him like he plotted and schemed to do to his brother. It sounds like his brother's around. This was just the plot that was hatched against him. So that's the idea. So they say, when it says a soul for a soul, it doesn't mean that he has to have actually been killed. But it's saying that if it's premature, that if it wasn't even decided yet that he should be killed, then it's not going to be good enough. So there was an argument between those who were the sages, who lived with the given over interpretation, the tradition of the Torah Shebaal Peh, versus the Tzedukim, who just read the text and decided based on the way it sounded to them. The Tzedukim said that it only would be appropriate to kill the witnesses when, based on the words of the witnesses, the subject was actually killed. The Chachamim say no, the opposite. It only applies when the brother, when the person is still around. If they were killed, no, then the Edom would not suffer this punishment. Instead, they say that it has to be that the person wasn't killed yet. On the other hand, what about the verse which says a soul for a soul, which makes it sound like there's been some finality here? To that they say, yes, there has to be some level where the testimony took hold, making it into a sack, into a decision that this soul was to be taken, or that this money was to be paid. If it was even more premature than that, then it won't count. The problem, the obvious problem, is that this seems to be counterintuitive. Right? The Gemara says, starts off and he says, look, if they didn't kill, then they do get killed. If they did kill, then they don't get killed. Omar Aviv, so his father said, Bini lav kal v'chaymer hu. I don't understand. Isn't it a kal v'chaymer? If they get killed for trying, how much more so that they should get killed for being successful? Answers the Gemara, so the son said, Limadatan Rabbeinu Sheinayin Sheminadin. You know, you taught us that we don't give punishments based on this kind of logic, and he brought the source for it, that we don't do it by a kal v'chomer. The Gemara speaks about a case of the prohibition against being with a sister who is a half-sister. And yet the Torah goes and says, and likewise for a sister who's a whole sister. So look, if this would be the rule for a half-sister, how much more so for a whole sister? That's how the Gemara gets into it. We don't have to go further about it right now. But that's the idea. It was obviously a controversial subject, and the Gemara goes and describes certain stories which happened in order to be able to illustrate this thing. So we can't punish based on a kal v'chomer. We can't assume and say, okay, look, if you give them this punishment for X, then for sure the same thing should be true for Y. So good thinking. So the question though is, you end up with a rather absurd sounding result. They get punished for trying, but they don't get punished for being successful. How could that be? And that is the problem which the Maral poses, a fair and reasonable question. How does the Torah produce something like that that's so counterintuitive? The question is posed to the Chachamim, right? The Tzedukim, the Sadducees, read the Torah and they said, yeah, fine, no problem. If they killed them, if they took a soul, then their soul gets taken. But the sages taught us a different tradition. And so this is a problem with the sages. It's not a problem with the verse. The way it's posed, it's a problem with the sages. The sages' approach seems very, very strange.
Excuse me. Does it also happen in terms of a case where it's just money?
Yeah. Same
so if
thing.
If the person already paid the fine,
right,
they don't have to pay
right.
the fine.
Right. Ki dovar zehu kechemetz l'shinayim u'cha'oshan le'inayim. He says this is, and he quotes the verse, the proverb in Mishlei, which says it is like vinegar on the teeth and smoke in the eyes. I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Okay,
excuse me.
That is what it was.
So the way the Maral expresses it, it's like vinegar on the teeth and smoke in the eyes. What does that mean? That you should be machmir more on somebody who didn't do, right? We would say like fingernails on a chalkboard, right? This is just, it's counterintuitive and it's very, very hard to make sense. How could it be that this would be the case? So the Maral, of course, begins with his words of care and of caution that, you know, we don't necessarily have to defend the Torah. It's godly words and godly rules, and therefore it's not necessarily to be assumed that we should just be able, with our regular, small, modest human minds, be able to figure this whole thing out. However, we will still, he says, Mikol Mokaim, Ha'emes Le'echeshe Ad Osim Ka'ar Tzidkam. He says, I will not be silent until I will show you the justice and the righteousness of these words, in order that all of the world will be able to realize that the thoughts that we have are not up to the thoughts of the Chachamim HaRishayim of the early sages. So I want to explain it to you. Now, before the Maral's explanation, I want to share with you the Ramban's explanation of this din. The Ramban is quoted by the Maral, referenced by the Maral here. It's quoted as well by the Maral in the Gur Aryeh. The Maral wrote a commentary, Gur Aryeh, on Rashi, a running commentary, and in the Gur Aryeh, on the verse of Kasher Zomam, where Rashi says you only give it to him if he plotted, not if he was successful, the Maral, in different words, advances the same explanations that he does here in the Be'er HaGola. In different words, you know, some small variation. Once said a Parsha Shir on this there. But the Maral over there in the Gur Aryeh quotes the Ramban more fully and expresses his objection to the Ramban more fully. But the Ramban says as follows. Also, something which is worthwhile to quote, not just because it's an alternative explanation to that which the Maral puts forward, but because it is also an insight into the words, into an attitude towards the words of the Chachamim. The Ramban says as follows, Kasher zaman v'lei kasher rasa, mikanam ruhargu ein herogim. It's only if he planned, not if he was successful. Tatam bozeh, explains the Ramban. What's the reason for this? Bavursh ki mishpat ha'edim azomim im b'gzeres hashalit, him shnayim u'shnayim. He says, the truth is that the whole din of edim zomim is Gzeras HaKosov. It's the kind of din that we can't necessarily so logically explain. What would happen if two witnesses came and said, Reuven killed Shimon at 1 o'clock in Baltimore on Tuesday? And another two witnesses came and said, no, we know that Reuven didn't kill Shimon at 1 o'clock in Baltimore on Tuesday. We don't know, we know because we saw that he was killed by, not by Reuven, but by George. We know that it wasn't that way because Reuven wasn't in Baltimore at 1 o'clock on Tuesday. What would we do? We would say, we don't know. We don't know who's telling the truth. Were the first set of witnesses saying the truth, or were the second set of witnesses saying the truth? The din of Edom Zomimim only applies if they come and say, what? You, Shmerel and Beryl, you say you saw Reuven kill Shimon at 1 o'clock on Tuesday in Baltimore? You couldn't have seen that because you were with us somewhere else. What's the difference? In both cases, it's two against two. Shmerel and Beryl say they were in Baltimore and they were seeing this murder take place. The second group says they weren't in Baltimore. Why do you listen to the second group over the first? Fundamentally, the Gemara says, and the Ramban is going here, is that it's a Gzeres HaShalit. It's a Gzeres HaKosov. The Ramban himself gives his own reason, his rationale for it, but we're not going to get into that right now. So he goes on and he says, when two come and then another two come and neutralize them, at the very least we kill the first set. Why? We say, look, you know why we're going to kill the first set of witnesses? Because we say the first set of witnesses set about to kill Reuven. The second set of witnesses came, even if you're going to call it a draw, what happened? Reuven got saved. Why did Reuven get saved? Because Hashem didn't want Reuven to get killed. And now let's take a step back and look at this story, and we see that this group, this pair, wanted Reuven to get killed, and Hashem didn't want Reuven to get killed. So then we're going to zing it to them. Avlinerag Reuven. But if Reuven did get killed, Nachshov Shaya Emes Kol Asher Heidu Olav Harishayim, we would say, you know what? Maybe that first group was right, after all. Kihu Ba'avonai Meis. He must have been guilty in his death. V'ilu Haya Tzadik Le'azvenu Hashem Bi'adam. If he was righteous, how could God allow this to happen? K'may Sha'amar HaKosav Hashem Le'azvenu Bi'adav Le'yashenu Bi'shavtoi. Hashem won't allow him, won't leave him into his hands. V'od, and furthermore, Shelo Yitein Hashem Ashoftim HaTzadikim Omdim Lefanav Lishpoch Dam Noki. This isn't the case where we would say, oh, you know, Reuven went and he mugged Shimon and he killed him, so let's let Reuven off scot-free. Why? Because he must have deserved to die, otherwise Hashem wouldn't have let Reuven kill Shimon. Right? That's essentially seems to be what the Ramban is saying over here. But the Ramban goes further and he says, this person didn't die from a mugging. This person died by the court that God appointed and inspired to do his wish. Would Hashem allow the Shoftim Tzadikim Ha'emdim Lefan of Lishbech Damnoki Ki Amishvat Le'elokim Hi? We say justice is God's, and these judges stand in the presence of God. Uvekerev Elokim Yishpait. Bine Kol Zeh Maila Gedoyla B'Shoftei Yisrael. Says the Ramban, this is really a testament to the esteem that the Torah placed upon the judges acting for the Jewish people. And it is the insurance that Hashem is supporting them, agreeing with them, and that he is with them as they are carrying out justice. These two people are standing with the rib before Hashem, because they're standing before Hashem when they come before the Kohanim and the Shoftim. V'hu yanchem b'derech emes. He says, the verse specifically says, they will stand before God here. Why do they say that? Because the Parsha is giving this sort of mystical weight to the words of the judges. So again, to summarize, the Ramban says that if the person wasn't killed, so then we see, this was all part of this terrible plot that wasn't destined to happen, that wasn't meant to happen, that didn't deserve to happen. So they're trying to kill an innocent man, and therefore they deserve the punishment. But if it happened, and it happened here in the Jewish court, in the Beis Din, that's considered to be functioning before God, we must give weight to what ended up occurring. And we give it such credence that it casts doubt and undermines any credibility that we would give to the witnesses who tried to challenge the first set of witnesses. The biggest proof, so to speak, in this case is in the pudding, is in the fact that it was allowed, so to speak, divinely to go through. That's what the Ramban says. Now the Maral has a problem with this Ramban, and I would probably say that it's the problem which is running through your minds at this point in time, which is that that's a very supra-rational consideration. Usually when we deal with justice, with punishment, with issues like that, we're going to deal with, as the Talmud says, Ein l'dayon ela ma she'ein av rayos. The judge goes by what they see. We call them as we see them. And as we see them, this is the way the testimony worked, this is the way the testimony failed. So the person got killed. What we see here is an unjust murder. A murder that if we would have been able to take it back, an execution which if we would have been able to take it back, we would do it in a flash. Shucks. Understatement of the year. Right? We killed him by mistake. That would be our legal attitude to what happens over here. Suddenly the Ramban says, we're going to say, oh, it happened. It must have been the right thing, and we're going to sleep very, very well tonight, and we're fine. And in fact, we're going to tell the witnesses, Shkoyach, you get off scot-free. It must have been, even though it seems to us like you're liars, but you must have not been liars. That's a very, very unusual way to view the situation, to expect it to be justified. Yes.
Isn't it even more than that? Isn't it that we discussed that HaKadosh Baruch Hu really turned over into our hands the determination of judgment? And according to Ramban, it's as if we're trying to divine, so to speak, Hashem's will, what he wants the outcome to be, which abdicates the responsibility for making the determination. You know, Lo Bashmaini,
right.
It's our job to make that determination.
Right. So what this Ramban, very good question, you're asking, you know, here you're, what you're doing essentially is you're saying that there's not really human responsibility here. You're making this all just a charade, you know, a puppet show where Hashem is making everything happen. How does that reconcile with the mandate on the Chachamim to work to understand, with Rabbi Yoshua's words to Rabbi Eliezer, forget the heavens, this is now left to us to decide. So Ramban here, and this is not only this Ramban, Ramban expresses similar ideas when we say in the mitzvah of Lo Sasur, and the sages have an expression that you should listen to the sages even if they tell you that right is left and left is right. Now what does that mean? Why should you listen to the Chachamim to tell you something which is wrong? Right? So the Ramban has both a practical approach where he says, look, there has to be a structure here of governance. There has to be a way that the Torah is given over. The Torah, Hashem said, I'm going to give it over to the sages. So look, you listen to them. And whether they're right or wrong, you listen to them, because that's just the way it is. Just like we would have with a teacher or with a boss, look, you can't be constantly second guessing, even if it's even if you might be right in a certain situation, but the structure is worth it, so to speak. But then the Ramban says a second idea, which is Kol Shekein, I think his language is, that you should really probably think that they're the ones who are right. And what looks to you as right is really left, as they said. And if there's any possibility like that, you should believe it. Why? Because, says the Ramban, there's a certain divine guidance and inspiration that would go in with those who God has entrusted with the Torah. That's not a functional thing. Look, God entrusted them, so you gotta go with them. That's a confidence issue. If God entrusted it with them, he doesn't just hand it over to them and go on vacation to the Caribbean. He hands it over to them and he helps them. And this approach is, in a certain sense, saying, okay, so forget human responsibility. But it's not really. What Ramban says here and there, what we find the same notion, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi writes about it in the Kuzari, is that even as people are working rationally and trying to figure things out by their thought processes and so on and so forth, but there could be at the same time a divine assist. The methodology is rational. The methodology is completely argument, consideration, let's see this way, let's see that way. But to then assume that because it's rational, God is a disinterested, so to speak, third party to this whole thing, and he plays no role in the rational process, is equally a mistake. I'll tell you how the Kuzari says it, and I think it's most instructive. The Kuzari points out the following halacha. The death penalty, we learn in the pasuk from Min HaMokai Mahu. When it speaks about the authority of the sages, it says the sages who submit rulings Min HaMokai Mahu from that place. Which place? From the temple. The supreme court building of the Jewish people, the Lishkas HaGozis, was part of the Beis HaMikdash, the temple compound. Why? The Gemara says that when the Sanhedrin was not on site in the Beis HaMikdash, so then they couldn't give the death penalty anymore. In fact, there was a point in time where the Sanhedrin felt that they were overwhelmed for whatever reasons towards the end of the Second Temple, and they were worried about their responsibilities and giving forward the death penalty. So you know what they did? They picked up and moved off-site. And that way they said, since we're not at the temple, we don't even have the option of giving the death penalty. So why should the Torah say that it's bound up with the positioning at the temple? It's learned from a pasuk. Sanhedrin right? The Sanhedrin should be right next to the Mizbeach, whatever it is, the details, there are many bases for it. But why? What's the rationale? The Kuzari explains fundamentally that the same way that Moshe Rabbeinu, who was not what we would call the rational guide of the Jewish people, he was the prophetic guide of the Jewish people, not chas v'shalom that he was irrational, but that his guidance was provided by going to God, hearing his word, and then conveying it to the people. Where did he get that? He got that in the temple. The Mishkan, the tabernacle, was built. It was built as a place of residence for Hashem's presence, where they would serve him, where they would worship him. And if he was there, and you wanted to hear from him, you wanted to speak from him, you went there too. Ramban famously says that the Jewish people had the one-time experience at Sinai, where God appeared with the cloud and the fire in the midst of the people to communicate with them, but they were going to move on from there. So therefore God said, build for me a tabernacle, a temple, and that will be modeled after Sinai. It will also be in the midst of the people. My fire, my cloud will be there. You will serve me there, and I will communicate. Any word which had to come to Moshe Rabbeinu would come from there. Says the Kuzari, even the Sanhedrin, that's not working with open prophecy, that's working just, so to speak, with the rationality, with thinking things through, arguments, derivations, and so on and so forth, but they also are benefiting from some level of divine inspiration, the hidden prophecy, not the open word. God comes and says, the halacha is like Reb Eliezer. But their arguments are infused with a boost of Ruach HaKadosh, of divine inspiration that helps them out. And therefore, we can only presume that it has that level of divine inspiration if it's in the place of divine residence. If it's in the Mishkan, if it's in the Migdash, where God's presence is, so you understand that that will strengthen them so much more so in being able to access that. So again, you ask a question, what about the rational responsibility? The sages are going through this 100% rationally. In their process of arriving at a decision, their tools are completely rational. They don't say, one second, let's have a seance and let's figure out what feeling we get here about what's going on, about the way this should be. They don't. They sit there with their eyes open, with their pencils sharpened. They're arguing back and forth. They're deriving. They're thinking. They're figuring it out. But in that, behind the scenes, there is still what we loosely call siyata dishmaya, divine assistance. I want to tell you a beautiful story. To me, it was a beautiful story. I once went, more than once, but one time I went to meet with a Gadol b'Yisrael, and I wanted to talk to him about a few issues, and we sat down, and I brought up a question, and the question which I asked him was like a philosophical question, it was like a general approach question. And he said to me, Rav Moshe, don't ask me a philosophical or general question. Ask me a very, very specific, practical question. And what came out to me from what he was saying was like this. If you're going to ask me about something that you want to do or something that you want to implement that's going to affect other people, so then it's not just that you're coming to me and you're saying, you know, he's smarter than me, he knows more than me, I can discuss it with him. But there's also going to be this boost of siyata dishmaya, of divine inspiration, because he, you know, his attitude towards himself was, look, you know, I'm sort of, you know, whatever brains I have, whatever knowledge I have, but I'm in this position that people all over the place are coming to ask me these questions. So God has got to be, you know, investing something in making sure that I'm doing a decent job. I mean, if he basically, in certain ways, has given me one of the oars that rows the boat of the Jewish people, and he wants to see that boat moving forward, he's got to be over my shoulder and helping me out. Theoretical questions, there's no oars for theoretical questions. Theoretical questions is when you lift the oars into the boat and you're just cruising and you're talking. A practical question is when you're steering, right? So for that, he felt that he had something extra to offer. There's not. It's not that, again, that he would sit there and have a say and says, this is what I feel, this is how I read the tea leaves, this is what my crystal ball says. He's going to think about it, he's going to give rational advice. But the rational advice can be helped by a measure of divine inspiration. This is a theme which is prevalent in the thinking of the Ramban. Ramban writes famously in Bava Basra, where it says, where it speaks about the transition from the period of the prophets to the period of the sages, and it says, now Chacham Adif Minavi, a wise man in sense is greater than a prophet, whatever the Gemara means there, the Ramban speaks about him and he says, the wise people now teach us with the Ruach HaKodesh Asher Bekirbam, with the divine inspiration that's inside of them. Not by open, visible things, but there is a certain divine interest and therefore divine inspiration there. That's the idea of the Ramban. And that, more time than I expected to spend on it, but that, of course, in the general theme which we're developing here, although Maharal doesn't subscribe to this particular interpretation in this particular place, but Ramban is very, very instructive. If the Beis Din, with God's presence, so to speak, rationally made this decision before the two other witnesses came screeching around the corner and saying, hold it, we must understand that this wasn't just the Beis Din's action, this was the Beis Din with God's action. And that has to temper our attitude towards those who made it happen. Not rationally in the fullest sense, but still, we got to say, I mean, if this happened, we've got to wonder. We've just got to wonder. This is the way the Ramban learns.
Isn't there also the fact that we would not have said this had there not been exists of cousins? So it's not like we're thinking back and say, well...
Correct. Now, part of it is definitely that the whole thing of two witnesses being accepting the second ones is a chiddush, and with this tempering it goes. There's sort of like three pieces to the Ramban, but this, you know, his final hammer blow is this idea. The Maharal objects to it. He objects to it both here and there. Here he says, "Let me modify that." The Ramban over here brings, he says, Kidover Zek Farnosan Rabbeinu Nachman Zal Befirsh HaTorah Tam L'Shevach. He already gave a nice reason for it. He says about the Ramban, but he says we want to give other good reasons. In the Gur Aryeh, which is his running commentary, he objects more specifically to the words of the Ramban, and he says, Ein davar zeh tam lismech al davar zeh. This would not seem to be a reason to lean on. Shaloi hayanerik devezin lechay makamachar. V'chomok amar ma'in ledayin amashayin v'rayis. Usually we say the judge has to go by what he sees. I call him as I see him. And the responsibility would be on the hands of, on the neck of the edim, and so on. It seems, again, beyond the rational. So the Maharal offers another reason. He really offers two reasons, but they revolve around the same idea. And this is a very, very subtle, interesting, abstract kind of a reason. But listen to it and think about it. Let's establish first a premise or two. The first premise is that what the Beis Din does or doesn't do does not necessarily reflect the ultimate punishment. In other words, these people, let's say they gave the edus, they gave the testimony, and the person got killed. So you say, okay, now Beis Din won't kill them. Does that mean that they didn't do anything wrong? I mean, if we accept that they lie, let's say we're going to go with the normal assumption, which is we usually accept the second group to say that they lied, then they did do something wrong. Ramban said, well, maybe they really didn't do something wrong. If it went through, they didn't do something wrong. But Maharal is saying, no, we go by what our eyes see. And the second group did something wrong, but they're getting off scot-free. Well, there are all kinds of people who get off scot-free, it seems, for all kinds of things. There are very, very specific and strict guidelines as to how you could ever carry out a Beis Din punishment against somebody else. So, that means that the fellow who murdered and was smart enough and quick enough to do it, always avoiding the proper situation of warning, of witnesses, of everything else, so he manages always to be the you know, tiptoeing through the tulips, managing to get around the punishment, that means, ah, this guy, terrific, he's in great shape. You wouldn't want to be with him after 120 years, that's all I can say, right? You know, we understand that the ultimate judge is not the best, and the ultimate judge is Hashem. And as we, yes, we're frustrated by it, and anyone who said the Shir Shel Yom of Shabbos hears David HaMelech's concern about it, but the response, which is that, you know, it takes a while. Judgment takes a while. Hashem, for whatever reasons, oftentimes allows the evil to flourish. Now, that doesn't mean that ultimately they'll flourish. This world is a little blip relative to eternity. And for eternity, they will suffer whatever they're saying on the radio and on television around this time. They will suffer damnation, right? You know, they would for eternity. They're not going to have it good, right? But for now, they're okay. So let's not be invested, says the Maharal, too much in the idea that we're going to say, oh, if they got killed, so then the witnesses get off free. If the subject got killed and the witnesses get off free, that must be what the witnesses did isn't so bad. He says, that's not correct. We're dealing here with issues of judgment as inflicted, as brought by the court, which normally is not always going to be reflective of exactly what's right and what's wrong. There are processes, there are issues in order to be able to do this. Illustration. In a sense, premise number two. Reuven doesn't like Shimon. Reuven really doesn't like Shimon. Reuven opens up the yellow pages under H, and he finds the listing for hitmen. Right? He finds Guido's number. He has a little eighth of a page ad in the yellow pages, and he calls up Guido and he says, Guido, there's this fellow Shimon. Do with him as is your minhag. And he pays Shimon. He pays Guido whatever it is. You know, the whatever you call it, the going rate, right? The union rates. And Guido knocks him off. So now what happens to Reuven? Nothing. Now what happens to Reuven? Nothing. Will something happen to Reuven ultimately? Of course something will happen to Reuven ultimately. Why?
Because he was responsible.
Because he didn't do it. He didn't kill anybody. Usually we say a setup, a cause, is not going to be chayev. Grumma, when a person causes something to happen, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be punished for it. In fact, usually they're not going to be punished for it. Usually grumma is potter, only maisa is chayev. Only when you did the action are you going to be chayev. But if you cause it, you're not going to be chayev. Right? If you go and you turn on somebody's garden hose. Now please, nobody get any ideas from this. Okay? You go, you have some fellow, you don't like him so much. So what do? You turn on the garden hose next to his house. One night, you turn on the garden hose next to his house. And the garden hose just starts running and running and running and running. And eventually, because he's not going to notice it tonight and he's not going to notice it tomorrow morning when he gets up bleary-eyed and leaves to work, after 16, 20 hours, the water is going to be building up because of where the water was near the house. And it's going to start seeping into his basement. It's going to ruin his carpet. It's going to ruin his couch. It's going to ruin his shelves. And it's going to keep him busy for a while afterwards. So now they go and they fingerprint the valve and they nail you. So what's going to happen? You know what's going to happen? Nothing now. Why? Because it would be one thing if you went and you poured water all over his basement and ruined it, but you didn't. You opened the valve, right? That the water eventually would trickle down. You didn't open the valve and put the hose. If you open the valve and you put the hose in the window, you know, you'd be chayav, but you didn't. You did it so in a place where it would eventually trickle down. The Gemara in Sanhedrin talks about cases where a person pulls the finger from the dike, so to speak, and it falls upon a person who's bound and gagged next to it. So the Talmud makes a distinction between an immediate result and an eventual result. Sometimes, even though you didn't go and pour the water on his head, but if you pulled it out and it immediately happened, it's tantamount to doing it with your own hands.
That would be like pulling a trigger on a gun.
In a sense, you could say that it would be like pulling a trigger on a gun, because that's just causing the hammer to go and so on, you know, and so on. But that might be worse, and it's certainly not better. It would be at least as significant. But if, you know, if it was more eventual, then he wouldn't be able to be hauled into court, because that's the way it works. You're chayav usually for a maisa, for an action. Eidim zomimim therefore becomes a tremendous chiddush, because forget the idea for a second of they're only going to be punished if they didn't do it, right? But just the very fact that for their words alone, where they just testify that so and so did this, which is really only a setup that then the Beis Din is going to do to so and so whatever they would do. So even if they did it, to say that the witnesses should be culpable would be a tremendous chiddush. It's not a normal halachic reaction.
Don't the Edom sometimes carry out the punishment themselves? So wouldn't that make it worse?
The din of Edom Zayim is certainly not contingent on them casting the first stone. So this is a problem. How would you say that they would be chayef? So what is Maral doing by that question? What he's saying is, you know, that to say, oh, if they killed them, they should for sure be responsible, is disingenuous. Why? Because Farkeret, if they killed him, we would say they shouldn't be responsible. If anything, you know who should be responsible? The Beis Din, the executioner. Now, the Beis Din and the executioner have valid excuses why they shouldn't be responsible. But not because they didn't do it, but because they did it unwittingly. But the Eidim, they didn't do it. Why on earth should you want to kill them? They didn't do it. They just set it up. Okay, very nice introduction. Now explain to me, but then why on earth should they be killed if they didn't get it done? That's even a greater anomaly, because you usually don't get punished for bad intentions. You usually get punished for bad actions. So Maral here says an idea, which is, it's a real idea, but it's something. Maral says that punishment, yes, punishment is usually for actions, for things that you have done. Kasher zomam is not a conventional punishment. Kasher zomam is the unfolding of your plan. Okay. See you guys next week. What does it mean that Kasher Zaman is the unfolding of your plan? So the Maral does something which is just, I don't know, to me this is like, this is a beautiful, beautiful use of verse. Okay? From good to verse. I'm sorry. Okay. The end of Megillas Esther. The end of Megillas Esther speaks in about the letter that Mordechai wrote up, sending it out to all of the kingdom of Achashverosh, declaring the days of Purim, including a synopsis of what happened. And it says as follows: Because Haman, ki Haman ben Amdasa Agogi, Haman, the great enemy of the Jews, Choshav al Yehudim la'avdam. He thought and he planned to destroy the Jews. And he made a pur, he made a lottery to confuse them and destroy them, to devastate them and destroy them. And when she came before the king, Esther, Omar im HaSefer, he said, and was inscribed, Yoshuv machshavto yara asher choshav al Yehudim al Roshay. That all of the thoughts which he had against the Jews should come back on his head. Salu oso vesbonov al ha'etz. And they hung him and his children on the tree that he had prepared for Mordechai. Says the Maharal, this is a scriptural application of Vasisem lo kasher zamam lasos le'echav. You will do to him what he plotted, what he thought to do to his brother. Haman set up the 13th of Adar as a day of destruction. The 13th of Adar was a day of destruction, but of his destruction instead of the Jews' destruction. Haman erected a very, very tall tree, a very tall tree trunk, whatever it was, pole, in his yard for somebody to be hung on it. And somebody was hung on it, but not quite the person that Haman planned, but it did happen. What's the idea here? The thoughts came to actions. They came into reality. They happened. Says the Maharal, and I'm giving you really a taktzir, a brief version of the Maharal. Maharal develops it far more fully, far more subtly, and it's so more subtly that I don't feel that I can really do justice to explaining it, because it's a hard, not the word I used before was a little bit of an abstract concept, and that's really the word. But listen to what he's saying. He says, a machshava, a thought, in a certain sense, by itself, is nothing. A thought, a plan, by itself, is nothing. But on the other hand, a thought is an engine. A thought is an engine that develops and that leads to those thoughts being carried out. And the engine, or we may call it the energy that's created by the thought, if it goes someplace, so then we'll look at it and we'll say, okay, now that energy of the machshava, of the thought, was transformed from what we would call the potential energy of the thought into the kinetic energy, into the actualization of it in the action. When that happens, says the Maharal, the thought, poof, it disappears. Thoughts and plans aren't what are significant. If you want to measure them in terms of what they actually are, they aren't. We don't punish a person for thoughts. We punish a person for actions. If these Edim said, we have a scheme, we have a plot that's going to get Reuven killed, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to testify, we're going to go this way, that way, the other way, and it works. And what happens is then Bezdin's executioner, that hooded guy, goes and kills them. So we say, it happened. But all you guys did were think and were plan and cause. When we look at this action, we say that action came from the hands of Bezdin. So you guys, with all your thoughts and all the things, look, we're not going to tell you that there's not going to be, quite literally, hell to pay for this. There will. But that's not the way we judge. We are going to go with, excuse me, with the actions. However, when the thought is hatched and it's created, and it hasn't yet developed into anything, we say the thought exists not as a crime, but the thought exists as an engine. The thought exists as something which was begun. And we say, you're planning this, we're going to see this plan through to fruition. Not necessarily that the engine is going to go in the direction that you pointed it so specifically, but it will produce that result, maybe on a different address. Haman plotted and he planned, and the plan produced a result, which was exactly the result that he expected and wanted, except what happened was that it boomeranged. and it bounced back and it hit him.
So we're not going to punish for the plan, we're going to rechannel your plan?
That's correct. That's kasher zamam. Kasher zamam is not a conventional punishment. It's not, because you did this, we're punishing you with that. That's, you killed, you get punished. For thoughts, we don't punish. For thoughts that produce actions that somebody else did, we might punish the person who did the action if they deserve punishment for the action, but for you, you're scot-free, so to speak, in terms of the earthly punishments. Kasher zomam is not a punishment. It is, maybe what we would say, a consequence. It's a result. It's the thought, the plan, coming into reality. Confoundingly, but it's coming into reality. When Achashverosh hung Haman, tell me something. Do you think he was saying, okay, we had a court case, and we've decided that since Haman was planning to kill Mordechai, who we know was a very good friend of the king, therefore Haman deserves a punishment that he should be hung. No way. That's not at all what happened. If they hadn't come in there, if Charvaina, right, wouldn't have popped in there and said, oh, and by the way, Mr. King, there's a big pole that Haman just put up in his backyard for Mordechai, that wouldn't have happened at all. It never would have happened. You know, maybe Haman would have been fired. Maybe Haman would have been thrown into jail. Maybe eventually they would have decided they would have killed him. But you know what they did? They took his plan and they made his plan come to pass. Now you would say, okay, well that's just, you know, happenstance, convenience, you know, a cute, so to speak, twist of fate. But yeah, there are a lot of very cute twists of fate that happen in Megillas Esther. And we view them as vivid miracles, as vivid as Geulas Mitzrayim, as vivid as the splitting of the sea and the turning of the water into dam. The idea was, literally, that the plan which he hatched should come to fruition. When Mordechai went and said, you know, the Jews are going to be destroyed on the 13th of Adar. And the king said, you know, the problem is I can't repeal that decree. I have a big problem. I can't repeal that decree. So instead of repealing that decree, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say that the Jewish people could go and stand up for themselves. In other words, the plan is going through. The plan is happening. It's going to be a day of confusion and of destruction, except the boomerang factor. The boomerang factor. The Maharal uses this idea to explain other things. But again, the idea is, if we would summarize it, is a machshava produces an energy. When that energy goes from the potential to the kinetic, the machshava ceases to be significant relative to the actual, to the kinetic. But until that happens, that machshava can go any place. And if you take the mirror, right, and you reflect the sunlight just right, you know what will happen. You know where it will bounce back to. You know what it will do. That's the idea of kasher zomam lasos lachiv. Kasher zomam lasos lachiv is the biblical expression for yashuv machshavtoi hara'ah asher chashav al yudim al reshai. Thoughts can be turned around. Actions, then it's dead already. Then it's done. And you want to decide for consequences after the fact. Thoughts that are turned around is because it's still alive. The thought is still alive and that energy is going to go someplace. Hargu, if they killed, the thought is finished. It already expired in a burst of action. And therefore there's nothing to come back. But it's kasher zamam if it's a thought and the thought took on the form of a gzeira. It took on the form of a decree, like the decree of Achashverosh. The thought has already massed and developed into something. Now, boom, it's got to go someplace. It's bursting out of its cage. Now, we'll say, okay, we're going to unleash it on you, Mr. Plotter, Mr. Schemer. That's the way the Maharal sees it. It's a completely different view, a completely different din. Isn't that, mamish, like, you know, on the one hand, it's radical, it's completely thinking out of the box. But isn't that just a magnificent way of explaining it? I it's a weird thing because I'm saying, Alana, I don't really understand and comprehend it completely because it's such an abstract idea. But on the other hand, it's such a structured, beautiful explanation to explain how this din works. Suddenly we have, out of the blue, a parsha in the Torah which deals with consequences for thoughts instead of actions, and specifically only when it's not an action. How does it work? Marel gives us such a beautiful structure to explain it.
How would the Marel distinguish between Adim Shebole and Sheker?
Yeah. So he doesn't. It's a very, very good question. What happens if it's not Zaymimim? Right? What happens if they're not Zaymimim? If it wasn't scheming, if the second pair didn't come to say Imanu Ha'isem, right? But it turned out that they were Edus Sheker. Now, it's a hard case that they were lying. You know, you weren't able to pull out the rug. Well, first of all, Edus Sheker is usually going to be Edus Mukheshes. It's sort of an impasse. You know, we don't know. You know who it is. The only way that we can determine for sure that Sheker Anav Achiv is going to be, usually when you're doing the witness thing, is going to be with the Parsha of Kasher Zaman. Now, but what happens if you happen to see Reuven walking around alive and well? So that's also going to be proving that they're Edus Sheker. We don't say this then. The Maral doesn't explain why it is that it's going to be only specifically in this case and no other possible case. You know, there's still here an element, obviously, of Xeris HaKosov. But it's, I think it just moves us, you know, in terms of understanding this din, way, way ahead. Are you
Marcus? It also gets the point that this is, as far as I know, the only idea where you have punishment that's just open-ended. You don't have open-ended punishments. And as Rambam doesn't explain, so we should give a punishment, you'll get skila all the time, get tefa all the time.
Right, it's exactly. Here, it's all kasher zamam. It's mamish kasher zamam. It's situational, because it's whatever energy you created, that's what's going
to
come there.
Is this like with Mitzrayim, the Jews were told not to go outside because the Malach HaMavis